Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This podcast is sponsored by Freedom Mortgage, dedicated to veterans and your homeownership needs. Visit freedommortgage.com/CBSVets, NMLS 2767, Equal Housing Lender.
This time on Vet Story.
I've got to ask, does Fred bark with an accent?
Yeah, I think other dogs would say, yeah, he does. We spent about 6 days just under constant attack. The Taliban and Sangin were bolder than anything we had seen in between mortar attacks and gunfights that I had spotted him a couple of times just kind of poking around. He wasn't a dog that had been hand-fed by troops or by anyone. He's been living his whole life in the dirt. I took a little piece of beef jerky from my ruck, and I just walked over towards him and was just like, what is this guy's deal, man? Because even the best behaved family dog back home, you know, take a ring off of your finger when they take something out of your hand. And he was the sweetest little guy. And Joe gets hit in the head. The very first day, he takes a round off of his suppressor, and the round hits him in the helmet and knocks him out. He remembers very vividly Fred came in and would lay with him for a little while at a time and check on him. And time wasn't on our side, because every minute that Fred was on Camp Leatherneck was another minute that he could get caught. I left it up to Fred, and I said, look, man, like if you follow me to the helicopter, if you're not scared off by the rotor wash and all the noise and stuff, then and you come, I'll be ready. And you pet a dog, if it's for 30 seconds or for 30 minutes, you know, that's what you're doing. And everything else around you kind of evaporates. He still rescues me just every day.
All right, welcome to another episode of Vet Story. I'm your host, Phil Briggs, sitting alongside my colleague, Matt Saintsing.
Hello, hello.
Happy Veterans Day to you, my
Indeed.
Friend.
Indeed, happy Veterans Day observed, right, where we don't have it off. We are still working here.
I know, right?
It's ironic.
But I'm glad to be working today to tell this veteran story. You have for us kind of a book report.
Of sorts, yeah. So Craig Grassi is a Marine.
Yeah, man.
That did intelligence work for recon Marines in Afghanistan in 2010. And he wasn't just anywhere in Afghanistan. He was in Sangin.
That's what I wanted to chat with you about before we get into his interview and talking about the book, Craig and Fred.
Yeah.
He was in Sangin. Bangin' in Sangin is what I've heard guys call it. About 2010, it was...
one of the hotter places in the country.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It was one of the nastiest places, one of the nastiest fights that we've seen in the global war on terrorism.
And he was with the Raiders, Special Operations Marine Corps Marines.
The MARSOC guys.
He was doing intelligence work for them.
Like the Corps 54,
I'm not sure who exactly went there, but I know he was attached to Marine Special Operations in Sangin. And of all things, he befriended a dog.
Amazing. Yeah. A little background on it, as I just threw out Corps 54 like I know anything.
All right.
I just interviewed another guy that was a MARSOC
Raider. Yeah, I remember that guy. Yeah,
not too long ago, and they are such badasses.
Oh, for sure.
It's intense work that they do, to say the least. Sangin was one of the bloodiest things we've ever seen over there. 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment did the initial clearing operations. 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment continued and is credited with completing the clearing phase. Sangin is considered by some the bloodiest battleground in Afghanistan for both the U.S. and the Brits alike.
That's crazy. And it's even crazier to think that, of all things, he smuggled a dog out of the country. And that's where the book comes in, Craig and Fred.
Very cool. All right, let's roll into the interview with a little clip from the book. Go ahead and read something that you really liked.
Fred quickly became popular in the compound. Within 48 hours, the guys started calling him Freddy, or Freddy Zone, a combination of his name and Combat Zone. "Hey, Freddy Zone," we'd call out in the stretches of afternoon when the compound was hot and quiet. Fred would mosey over for a pet and a treat, happy for the attention. I started to share my MREs with him here and there. One day, I smeared peanut butter on the roof of his mouth, and he sat there licking his lips, trying to reach every last bit with his tongue, while I giggled. He was like a little brother.
That's awesome.
Before we get into that, I've got to ask, does Fred bark with an accent?
Yeah, I think other dogs would say, yeah, he does. I mean, he's got a very unique pitch to his bark, and it's almost like its own little language. You can tell kind of what's going on, you know, what he's barking about just by the sound of it. And yeah, when we go to the dog park and he barks at other dogs, it kind of stops them in their tracks, and they kind of look at him like, what was that?
Yeah, for sure. You first joined the Marines in 2003, but when you first joined, you know, I joined the Army in 2003 as well. When you joined the Marines, it wasn't exactly what you hoped for, and it kind of led you on a different path. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, I learned a hard lesson, I think, that a lot of vets learn. You know, if you join the military to do what you want to do, you got the wrong idea. And I had like a lot of, you know, new enlistees. I had high hopes, and, you know, I envisioned, you know, doing a couple years in the military police and maybe working, you know, on a canine team. And actually we invaded Iraq while I was at Paris Island going through boot camp. And so I kind of had this vision of what my, you know, we had transitioned from peacetime recruits to wartime recruits, and everything was different. And then my first 4 years, the closest I got to a traditional, you know, combat deployment was being sent to Gitmo and working on the cell blocks in Gitmo. And then the rest of my time was spent working, you know, in correction facilities and brigs, within our own military. And that, it was just not at all what, I mean, not even a sliver of what I had envisioned for my time. But I did know one really important thing after those first 4 years, and that was I loved being a Marine, and I was, you know, just in love with the culture and what the Marine Corps represented. And I knew I was okay at it, you know, and I wanted to just find, I was frustrated, but I wanted to find my role.
I can definitely relate to that because, you know, I was in high school when 9/11 happened, and then right when I graduated high school in 2003, that summer I went right to basic training, and my plan was, I'm going to go to Afghanistan and I'm going to find bin Laden. You know, like this is like the, yeah, this is like, right. This is the image, you know, bright eyed and bushy tailed when I was at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And then the Army in its infinite wisdom decided to send me to Iraq twice. I've never even been to Afghanistan. So,
right. Okay. Yeah.
It's definitely definitely a story of like, get what you want out of the military, because they're definitely going to get what they want out of you. So
that's right.
Yeah.
And in those first 4 years, I mean, I made some amazing friends that I'm still close with today. And I had, you know, it's just like any job, you know, you might not love it, but there's always going to be opportunities to get something out of it. And that's just the way you have to approach it.
Yeah. So you went back to the Marines, but this time is a little different. And the work you're doing eventually led to, as you said, to work with intelligence and with the elite recon Marines in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So what was your path like?
Yeah, I mean, it was finding the field of human intelligence was kind of a crazy little path. I mean, I was talking to prior service recruiters and different people to try to figure out what I could do when I got back in. And there was this one prior service recruiter that happened to have a couple of guys from the human intel field downstairs in the office downstairs. And he just sent me to them, and cause they do all their own recruiting and all their own screening. And that kind of kicked off about a year's worth of just boarding and training before I could even have the opportunity to go to the school. And so it was just a long path, but I could tell right away that I was on the right one, just being in the room with those guys and the people that did the job. You know, I could tell that it was the right field for me. And so, once I completed all the training and got a new MOS and redesignated, it was just a matter of waiting for, you know, the workup for a deployment to Afghanistan was a year. And so we were just kind of constantly training, and I took it upon myself along with one of my friends, to just make sure we were in the best shape possible.
Yeah.
Because we knew pretty early on that we were going over in a general support role, so we weren't specifically assigned to any unit, and so we could have ended up, you know, screening base workers, or I could have ended up right back in a detention facility, screening detainees and on Camp Leatherneck, and spent my whole deployment on Camp Leatherneck, and that the idea of that just drove me insane. So me and my friend PJ were just in the gym kind of constantly between classes and between training, and just making sure, you know, that our command, if something came down the line for a unit like recon or a traditional infantry unit, that, you know, we would be the first ones that they thought of. And it worked out. That was it's exactly the kind of the impression that we made on our command. So within the first week and a half of being at Camp Leatherneck, recon came down and said they needed a collector for an operation just outside of Marja, my name was the first one kind of out of the mouths of my leadership, and then the rest of it was on me. I really had to prove myself to those guys and show them that I brought something to the battlefield that they couldn't necessarily provide for themselves, and that I could keep up with their patrol pace and their operations in general. And that's that first operation in just outside of Marja, making that strong impression on them led them to just kind of adopt me for the rest of their deployment, and then for them to pass me off onto second recon when they ripped in. And that's what led me to Sangin, and that's what led me to Fred, was that, you know, that preparation and just being ready to operate at that tempo.
I gotta say, when I was in the Army, I was a signals intelligence analyst too, and I was in the 101st Airborne, and I just cannot stress enough, just even like having your PT right, or kind of being like a good soldier or a good Marine, when the time comes to go to an operational unit, or you're going down to support an infantry or special operations community, they want to know that you bring a set of skills, and they don't have to babysit you. And when you come from the intel community or from some other support areas, it's kind of on you to prove that. So I can definitely relate to how you're trying to kind of step it up to prove you're the best type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they're not looking for you to be a good shooter, or, you know, be as good as them with a rifle or with a, you know, with land nav or anything like that. But they want you to be able to hold your own. That's for sure. Yeah.
In the mess that is Afghanistan, you found an unlikely friend. Now, Fred, who's your first dog, right?
Yep.
And
yeah.
Tell me about the first time you met Fred.
Yeah. So that was we spent about 6 days just under constant attack. The Taliban and Sangin were bolder than anything we had seen, and it was just kind of in between defending ourselves and in between mortar attacks and gunfights that I had spotted him a couple of times, just kind of poking around, you know, by himself. He was kind of a loner, and he always was just kind of during the day was out walking around, which was unusual. Most of the times we saw dogs, at least when they were really active, was at night when it was cooler. So I kind of spotted him and was just kind of curious, but it wasn't the right time. And after a little while, the Taliban kind of let up on us, because those recon guys were really giving it back to him pretty effectively. And so things calmed down just a little bit. And I saw Fred. He had a little clump of bushes that he kind of made his own little den. I could see where he had buried scraps of food and little bones and stuff. And he was just kind of laying in it, trying to get out of the heat. You know, I couldn't resist. He is my first dog, but I've always loved dogs.
Same.
He just was so intriguing. You know, just the way he looked and the way he carried himself. And so I took a little piece of beef jerky from my ruck, and I just walked over towards him, and I could tell as I got a little closer. You know, I could tell he was really dirty, just kind of that matted fur that happens when you know, he's been living his whole life in the dirt, and he was covered in these crazy bugs. They were like, they looked like flying ticks. Like they would land on him, but they would burrow into his hide, and they were all kind of around his neck and on top of his head. And he was obviously, you know, malnourished and just hot and uncomfortable. And so, you know, an animal like that, you know, they have every reason in the world to not really trust you and just kind of, you know, snap at you. And so I approached him pretty cautiously. And as I got a little bit closer, he did something that has left an eternal impression on me, and it's really just kind of, to me, the one of the most important moments of my life. And he started to wag his tail, and that really just, like, right away just stopped me in my tracks, because, you know, this dog had absolutely nothing to wag his tail about, you know. And he wasn't a fob dog. He wasn't a dog that had been hand fed by troops or by anyone, you know, in his life. But he was holding on. He was holding on to his hope. And it turns into, you know, what I now call stubborn positivity. You know, despite having every reason in the world to descend kind of into negativity, into a negative mindset, he remained positive, and he wagged his tail at a total stranger. And so I knelt down and I gave him held out the piece of beef jerky, and he surprised me for a second time when he kind of stood up and came over and took the beef jerky as gently as he possibly could with his front teeth, you know, and chewed it very politely. And I was just like, what is this guy's deal, man? Because even the best behaved family dog back home, you know, take a ring off of your finger when they take something out of your hand. And he was the sweetest little guy. And so that was kind of our first meeting. And from there, he kind of just came into my life and the lives of the guys that I was with, and we're still at it.
Yeah, and it seems in the book that Fred kind of took you out of the fight in the sense that you obviously were in Afghanistan, but that moment you describe when you saw him first wagging your tail and kind of just spending time with Fred, and with Fred spending time with the team, you know, finding something else in combat. Especially when you're deployed, can be really difficult. Having to focus on something else is really hard. So how's Fred able to do this with you, and how he's able to win over the hearts of these fierce recon Marines?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right, because you can only read the same magazine so many times, or listen to the songs on your iPod, you know, so many times, and eventually, you know, to try to escape the reality. So Fred. It's just that unique power that dogs and animals in general just have, you know, when you sit down and you pet a dog, if it's for 30 seconds or 30 minutes, you know, that's what you're doing. And everything else around you kind of evaporates, and it's valuable. Your blood pressure drops, and, you know, and you're just content. And Fred, you know, it didn't matter, you know, how hard we were as far as Marines go, you know, like that's a powerful thing. And we were all susceptible to it. And it was so important to us, because that fight was rough, and the constant bombardments and the long nighttime patrols, you know, just the connection that we all had with Fred was so valuable and so important.
Was there a trust issue at first? Because I can only imagine a feral dog anywhere in the world would be a little bit wary of strangers, let alone in a place where gunshots, mortars, and rockets are often heard in really close proximity. So I'm kind of amazed that you're able to form this bond so quickly with a dog that really kind of seemed down on his luck.
You're right. I mean, but it was instant. Even before I made my first contact with Fred, he had kind of started to become one of us, and to kind of break down that barrier of mistrust between, you know, an animal and people. And that scene in the part when Murdy Joe gets hit in the head, the very first day, he takes a round off of his suppressor, and the round hits him in the helmet and knocks him out. And I think readers will really see it, and that was, you know, our first glimpse. And I didn't know about that part of the book or that took place until I reconnected with Joe while I was writing. And he told me, like, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. He had a really severe traumatic brain injury, but he remembers very vividly, like, we had to put him in a dark room so he could recover while we waited for the medevac. And Fred came in and all on his own. This was before I fed him jerky or anything. And Fred came in and would lay with him for a little while at a time and check on him. And so, in other circumstances, yeah, it would be more like, you know, kind of slowly breaking the dog of the mistrust and those habits of not getting along with humans. But Fred was, it was like he was waiting for us. It was like we were kind of destined to come across this little guy.
Now, his journey home is also unique in the fact that I think he was in a helicopter before he was even in a vehicle, right?
Yeah, right.
Which is this?
Yeah, you know, I love that.
So crazy when we talk about dogs going for car rides here in the States. It just seems so routine.
Yeah.
But, you know, he got really first class ticket, or maybe not so first class. But tell me a little bit about how you got him to the States, and how you and a couple other people took some chances and broke some of the rules along the way.
Yeah, I mean, the course of time in the field with him really, it demonstrated that, you know, he would do anything for us, and he was worth taking that risk for. And to me, the final kind of action that he took to demonstrate that was following me to the helicopter, because that was the last little sign that I needed, because we were coming up with schemes and we were coming up with plans. Like, we'll give him Benadryl, or we'll try to just we'll make a leash and try to walk him on the back of the helicopter. Just like, maybe nobody will notice. We'll think he's a working dog. Like, we had all these little schemes, but ultimately I didn't want it to feel, I didn't want to feel like we were just stealing him or that we were forcing him. And so I left it up to Fred and I said, look, man, like if you follow me to the helicopter, and you're not scared off, like any other normal feral dog or any normal dog would be, you know, because they have to train military working dogs to run onto the back doctors and do stuff like that. But if you're not scared off by the rotor wash and all the noise and stuff, then you come, I'll be ready and I'll honor that and we'll see what we can make happen. But I didn't really have a huge plan after that. And sure enough, we were running on the back of the helicopter and I feel a little poke at my heel and don't get me wrong, he was terrified. He was so scared, but he was coming. And so I had a little duffel bag in my car, stuffed in my cargo pocket. And my buddy Top, the master sergeant on the mission, reached down and grabbed Fred by the back of the neck. And we stuffed him in this duffel bag and zipped it closed. And that's how he rode out of the field, was just kind of as a stowaway in our duffel bag. I just did my best to make it look like it was some gear, so nobody on the helicopter would have noticed. But I got lots of little smiles and nods from the recon guys as we rode. It was about an hour flight, maybe a little longer, back to Camp Letterneck. And from there, it was when where the story really, really unfolds. And the more I write it and the more I talk about it, the more I can just see, how crazy it was, because it could have gone wrong very easily from there. I mean, Camp Leatherneck is a really fortified place, and it's the kind of place, you can't even walk around with a bad shave, let alone have a dog in your room. And so from there, it was up to me, and luckily I had a lot of awesome people that came into play, and people that from unexpected places and just with no reason really to help, other than just a love of Fred and a love of what is good. It was up to a crew of DHL workers, to really step in and take care of him, because we only had a 2-week break back at Camp Leatherneck before we were going back out into Sangin. And that wasn't enough time to get him home. So, these guys they worked for DHL, but they were third country nationals. They were from countries in Africa and East Asia and all over the place. And they loved Fred. And Fred loved them. Fred really showed them, who he was. They practically begged me to let them watch him while I went back out into the field. And then back home, my sister was doing a lot of phone calls, taking a lot of phone calls and writing a lot of emails, reaching out to different groups to try and get Fred home. And at the time there wasn't a lot of traction for stuff like that in Afghanistan. There was a pretty firm way to get it done in Iraq, but their groups you know, were sporadic, and it really just ultimately took a lot of time, and time wasn't on our side, because every minute that Fred was on Camp Leatherneck was another minute that he could get caught. So that was what kind of led me to breaking the rules and to doing whatever it took to get him home. And I took as many steps as I could in terms of just verifying that he wasn't contagious, and that he didn't have any kind of a disease that would be a risk to anybody along the journey. And I was lucky that a really kind British Army vet agreed to give him an exam and just kind of just for peace of mind. And it made it a little easier to fudge the forms that the customs forms and the veterinarian forms with her evaluation under us. Yeah, and it was just a matter of kind of just getting it done and not asking too many questions and just doing what needed to be done to get this little guy home.
Yeah, so it sounds like Camp Leatherneck is like close to the flagpole, as they say, where if you're at a uniform, you're going to hear about it, like no more than 10 steps outside your hooch. So the fact that you smuggled a living, barking friend is nothing short of insane. When I was reading that, and I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. So, in the title of the book, it says, "And How They Rescued Each Other." So, mm-hmm. you know, coming home from combat, you know, is a story, you know, people in the veteran and military community have heard a thousand times. But this was Fred's coming home story too, really, and he's coming home to an area that he was never a part of. So talking about how he kind of helped you get over some struggles.
Fred, to me, just, you know, he still rescues me just every day. Just looking at him, you know, and watching him, you know, chase a squirrel or play with another dog, you know, he to me is a reminder of what I'm capable of. Of what, you know, like I got him out, you know, and like, and it's, you know, he kind of reminds me of what is possible, you know, when you stand up for something like, you know, something that's good. And then just, you know, going back to that first day when he wagged his tail at me, you know, like that, he's a reminder to me of the power of positivity and what is possible when we understand that it's not what happens to you, but how you react that matters and just being stubbornly positive. And so, you know, coming home and making that transition, you know, was challenging for me, and it's challenging for every vet. And you're right, it is a story that we're really familiar with in the veterans community. But I think what's important for us to realize in that, is that everybody's is different. And I think, you know, I think that sometimes when we transition the way in the programs we go through and the things that we're told, we're meant to think that, you know, it's just something that's supposed to happen kind of quickly, and that there's only one way to do it, or there's only a couple ways to do it. And I think that you know, I think the more we realize as veterans that it's a slow transition, and that it doesn't have to happen quickly, and that it's ultimately our transition to make, you know, and that it doesn't have to be like anyone else's. You know, that's important, and it can, you know, just kind of, you know, just slow down a little bit and really think about your options. And that's, you know, kind of what looking at Fred and just kind of sharing our story over the years has really, you know, helped me transition into writing and realizing how much I love storytelling. And so that's one huge way that he's impacted me since Afghanistan.
Yeah. And you're up in Maine right now, but you're getting ready to go on a book tour of sorts. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we're really excited. We're going to be starting out in Rhode Island, and then working our way through Connecticut and New Hampshire and New York and New Jersey and all the way down into D.C. And there's a lot of really great events and book signings. And I'll be doing some readings and taking questions, and Fred will be along on the journey, so people can come out and get a look at him. And
that's the big seller. That's the big seller.
Yeah, exactly. You want just a starting point? You can just go to our website, fredtheafghan.com, and it's all laid out for you right there. And we have two editions. We have a regular adult edition, and we have a young reader that's designed more for 8 to 12 year olds. And it's just a little bit more of a sanitized version, but all the messages and all the great stories are still in there. And And so we're really excited that we have two books to get, you know, it's just another opportunity to share our story with different audiences. And that's, you know, we're really proud and really, really excited about that.
That'll do it for this episode of Vet Story. I'm Phil Briggs, wishing you a happy Veterans Day. And know from all of us veterans here, to all the veterans out there and their four-legged best friends, we thank you and honor the sacrifices that you've made. I'll talk to you again on another Vet Story real soon at connectingvets.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.